In Ellen Oman's new novel, By Blood, a man in a rented office overhears the conversations between a psychotherapist and a patient and becomes intrigued and then obsessed with the patient's story, which involves searching for her birth mother and unraveling the mysterious circumstances of her adoption. It's published by Farrah Straus and Giroux, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Ellen Oman back to our show today. Hello.
My pleasure.
The story is told by a male narrator that we know very little about at the beginning. Who is he?
He's a disgraced professor. We don't even know the exact nature of his transgressions. He's a voyeur and maybe something of a stalker. And it wouldn't be in his character to tell us too much about himself.
So should we assume that he's a somewhat unreliable narrator?
Absolutely. Everybody in this book lies somewhat.
Uh-huh. And it's up to us as the readers to figure out what's really going on?
Yes. Yes, I mean, this is the problem with the unreliable narrator, that somehow the reader has to know the person is not disclosing all, but intuit that behind that story there's a reality.
Does that involve sticking in little red flags along the way?
Not to me. I think
that's not the way you proceeded.
No, and there are each individual voices, that stories told within stories, each person speaking in their own voice.
So this man is in his office one day when the normally muffled sounds next door suddenly become clear, and that's when he realizes that his office neighbor is a psychotherapist.
Which annoys him horribly because he's got an unspecified nervous condition. He's been to therapists, psychoanalysts, counselors his entire life.
But he's also a voyeur. This gives him an opportunity to practice his little kink. This is because there's a patient who doesn't like the white noise machine that the therapist normally uses?
That's right. That's the first thing he notices after it gets quiet is a voice saying, "Thank you, I hate that thing," and the therapist replying, "So sorry, I do forget."
Does the narrator feel any guilt for eavesdropping?
No, he insists immediately that he doesn't know what he's overhearing. Who are all these names? Charlotte, Peter, my work, my assignment. And so he says, well, how can I be trespassing? I've no idea what I'm listening to.
And he doesn't see this as creepy. He just sees this as kind of human interest.
He does see it as creepy. He then berates himself. He says, it's too close to a posture I swore I would not take again.
Well, we've been in situations where we've overheard really interesting conversations. More often than not, it works the other way. We wish those people in the elevator or the subway or talking on their cell phone wouldn't let us know so much about their lives.
Yes, but I'm a terrible eavesdropper. If I'm in a restaurant, well, if people are talking loudly, you're right, and if they're not interesting, I want them to be quiet. But if there's an interesting conversation going on and the people choose to speak in a loud voice, I will say to my dinner companion, shh, 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 shh. I'm listening.
Because this is something that can really work for a novelist?
Yeah. I think we're stealers of lives.
I think it was Hart Crane or some poet who would take little things that he heard people say in public, and that would be the inspiration for a poem.
I don't write poetry, but when people tell me stories with particularly interesting detail, I say, if you don't use it somewhere, I'm going to use it.
So your narrator becomes fixated with this patient, making sure he's always in his office when she has an appointment. And is it because her story is so compelling that he's drawn to her?
He's alone. And the first thing he feels is he tries to stay away. He feels it's wrong to be overhearing this. But his loneliness and the sort of darkness of his mood, as he calls it, draws him back. He says, this is the only person in all of San Francisco I can say with any truth that I know. So he gets involved with her story.
You wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times about being adopted. Are you in favor of adoptees finding out their origins, who their birth parents are, and the circumstances of their adoption?
I think it's a complicated issue for each person. To some extent, it's, I think, a relief not to know. I mean, you can make up your history. And I have various imaginary parents over the years, depending upon social conditions. On the other hand, there is this deep drive to understand, who do I look like? Where did this part of me come from?
And why am I so different from the people who I've been calling my parents? But then there's also, isn't there just medical curiosity. Sometimes it's important to know whether your parents died of cancer when they were young.
Absolutely. Going to a doctor and they ask for your family history, I just write adopted, no knowledge. Yeah, everyone in my family could, you know, died of cancer, you know, the next year. And in some way, it's good not to know that.
Is this the first time you've used the subject of adoption in your writing?
Yes.
I mean, in your fiction writing?
Yes.
But you have written about it in essays and articles.
Just that one. My previous essays have been more about the social effects of technology and my experience as a computer programmer and software engineer. I felt I had to explore a different part of my history, and that's when I wrote the piece about adoption.
Well, the relationship between a therapist and patient is something that goes back to the early 20th century in world literature. I think Confessions of Zeno, there may have been a few others, and of course Philip Roth has used it. What interested you in writing about the relationship between the therapist and her patient?
Well, I might confess I've been through a little therapy myself. And I did have one therapist who was encouraging me to think about my adopted status, and I resisted her terribly. So in some ways, this may be a way that I'm exploring that therapeutic relationship.
The patient talks a lot about being adopted and about her mission to find out who her birth mother is. Does the therapist encourage her in this?
Well, at first she resists. She says, "I am not adopted. I have mysterious origins." And the therapist is not so much encouraging her to find her birth parents, but to deal with the issue of mismatch, serious mismatch with her very waspy parents.
I don't want to give away too much, but what does the patient find out about where she comes from?
Well, it's on the back, the book jacket. I don't write these things. People do, but...
Does that bother you when you get a review, for example, and the reviewer reveals something that you worked very hard to conceal until the right moment?
One reviewer, I will not mention where, actually disclosed the very last paragraph of the book. And it's unconscionable. I was startled at someone doing that.
So how do you deal with that? Well, in the case of your book, did you say to the publisher, did you have to put that on the book cover?
I think they do to some extent, and I accepted that, that people need to know the sort of broad subject matter of the book. And this young woman finds her origins as she was born after World War II to a Jewish mother in a displaced persons camp. To me, that's a story that hasn't been told enough. What happened to surviving Jews in Europe? Borders were closed to them. In the case of Bergen-Belsen, they made a sort of their own community, self-governing, and in some ways a very inspiring story.
My guest is Ellen Ullman, who's written a novel called By Blood. This is her second published novel, published by Farrar, Straus and Giroux. Why does the narrator seem to envy the patient for being adopted?
Well, he feels oppressed. He comes from a long line of suicides, and they've killed themselves in various creative ways. And he feels that he has this black drapery of his condition, that he's inherited this. And he envies someone whom he feels can be self-created, like an adoptee.
In a way, you have two narrators here, because we have this man, and then we have the woman telling her story. And that must have been fun for you, because you had to switch personae throughout the book.
I think there are four, actually. There's the outer narrator, the professor, and he overhears the therapy on the young woman telling her story. We hear something from the therapist herself. She's seeking consultation about this problematic therapy, and one night the narrator hears her recording. And then there's the mother.
And he learns about her background.
And what he think may be her biases in the story. And then we get to the birth mother herself, and the patient, very conveniently for us, has recorded the conversation so we can hear it back.
At one point, the narrator decides to get involved with the patient and her story. And this is a temptation for many people in therapy. They sit in the waiting room, and maybe they hear snatches of somebody else talking, or they hear somebody crying, and then that person emerges, and they become curious. I guess that's where that idea came
from. Absolutely. And, you know, he has from a very young age, those white noise machines, he realizes that it's supposed to cover the therapeutic conversation, but he can't help but trying to listen.
Now, did you do any research on how much you can hear through a wall?
Actually, this is based on a writing office that I have in an old building, very much like the one in the book. There was a matchmaking service next door, and one night I heard the matchmaker come in, introduce a couple, and their halting attempts to start a conversation. Now, I listened, but I told the woman the next day that I could hear, and she was nonchalant. She said, oh, we're moving in a month. Don't worry about it. So it set the whole scene for me.
Well, that's that's a short story, don't you think?
Well, it turned into a long story somehow.
It turned into this novel. As you mentioned earlier, you used to be a computer programmer. How does writing novels compare to writing code?
A very different experience. Code is a very bounded and structured conversation with a chip, a device interface, an instruction set, a compiler. It's a very strict language. It's creative. When someone creates an elegant algorithm, you can sense it somehow in the code. But it has to be precise, whereas language, its beauty is that it's not precise. There could be no poetry otherwise.
Well, you've set this book in the 1970s, before so much of the technology we live with today was developed. And obviously that was important to you. Add to the mystery?
Yes. Well,
you can't Google the person.
That's exactly right. And also, the 70s were a wild time in San Francisco. I arrived there in early 70s. Patty Hearst had been kidnapped and not found. Symbionese Liberation Army, the Zodiac Killer was still at large. Shortly after the period in this book, our mayor would get shot. And Harvey Milk, Supervisor Harvey Milk. And it was a gritty time. The entire country was in the great stagflation, and the whole period seemed ripe for maybe a gothic atmosphere.
But despite that, it was a time when we had a lot more privacy if we wanted it. We didn't have the internet. We didn't have Facebook. We didn't have all sorts of things that now really reveal an awful lot about our personal lives, in some cases, to our surprise.
Absolutely. There is a sense where it's not so much that you've just lost control over your entire actions. People can find out way too much about you. In some ways, that may be desirable. The trade-off is supposedly you're being offered things you're really interested in, and you're being offered connections with people you really want to know, but the price is very high.
Well, you also can reveal things about yourself when you write op-ed pieces called My Secret Life for the New York Times. I'm sure you did it partly because you wanted people to read your book, but you have to decide just how much you want to tell about yourself in a memoir. Somebody's talked about the whole process being as much about what's left out as what's put in.
Well, my first book was a memoir called Close to the Machine, and I was really aware that this book, the patient, the young woman in here, had to be not me. Because in a memoir, there's a natural tendency to protect yourself and not reveal the most embarrassing aspects of your life. Same with the characters in here. They are not in mood to tell you everything wrong with them. Even the patient, of course, you know, you don't reveal all to your therapist. So it was important for me to have that distance so I wouldn't be protecting her from looking foolish or prejudiced or any of the other negative emotions.
Alan Ullman's previous novel, The Bug, was a New York Times notable book and runner-up for the Penn Hemingway Foundation Award. The memoir, Close to the Machine, based on her experiences as a programmer during the early years of the personal computer era, has become something of a cult classic. And now, a new novel by Blood, which is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's been my pleasure.